Deutsche Welle. Africa Link.
And welcome to Africa Link. I'm Mark Caldwell in Bonn, Germany. In this edition of the programme, pressure mounts on Mali to restore civilian rule 1 week after a military takeover.
The coup that was led in 91, people went out in the streets to celebrate and to welcome the coup, and this is not happening this time. In some ways, this seems like it could be some sort of accidental coup.
And the refugees at a camp in South Sudan, who, having just escaped the fighting, have to move yet again because of flooding.
These people, when they flew from the location, they came, they tried to find a better place to stay. So when they came here, they came straight up to this area, and we found some most of them here, and now we're trying to move them to the safe area.
Those stories and more coming up on this edition of Africa Link. Stay tuned.
Top story.
One week after a military coup in Mali, a group of African presidents is to visit the country in a bid to try and restore civilian rule. But although the regional bloc, ECOWAS, and the international community are shunning the junta that drove President Amadou Toumani Touré into hiding, thousands of people have been joining pro-junta demonstrations in the capital, Bamako. Susan Holton reports.
Crowds of several thousand were out on the streets of Mali on Wednesday in support of the coup leader's move to seize power and write a new constitution. This has been seen as a move to allay fears that the military leaders would try to cling to power. Details of the new constitution were revealed in a TV address on Tuesday. The putschists announced that their members would be barred from taking part in upcoming elections. A nighttime curfew has also been lifted and the borders reopened in an effort to show the country is returning to normal. The new constitution would herald the rule of law and basic human rights in a pluralist democracy, a soldier said as he read from a prepared statement. The televised address came on the same day as a meeting of West African leaders in the Ivory Coast moved to suspend Mali from the Regional Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS. President of the ECOWAS Commission, Kadre Désiré Ouédraogo, announced that a delegation of regional heads of state would be arriving in Mali on Thursday, led by Ivorian President Alassane Ouattara.
La conférence décide de nommer son excellence Monsieur Blaise Compaoré, président du Faso.
The Abidjan summit also named Blaise Compaoré, president of Burkina Faso, as mediator, with the mandate to engage the coup leaders in fruitful dialogue for the restoration of peace in the country. Ouédraogo warned that all necessary measures would be taken to end the rebellion and secure the territorial integrity of Mali, including the use of force.
Y compris par l'utilisation de la force.
The ECOWAS Commission has been instructed to put the ECOWAS standby force in a state of readiness for all eventualities. The European Union, the United States, Canada and other Western countries have announced the blocking of hundreds of millions of dollars in aid to Mali. Donors say, however, they will continue with emergency aid for drought-hit regions of the country. The United States' position had been that it is not too late to reverse the situation. State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland said Washington had spoken with coup leader Captain Amadou Sanogo and had delivered a clear message that it's not too late to undo this and allow the country to return to civilian rule. However, once the ECOWAS delegation begins direct talks with the coup leaders, the chances that they will back down must be regarded as minimal.
Susan Holton. For more insight into what is happening in Mali, I turn to Benjamin Suarez. He's an expert on the country at the African Studies Centre in Leiden in the Netherlands. I asked him if the new constitution written by the coup leaders could be a stepping stone out of this crisis, or would other ECOWAS countries just brush it aside?
Well, I think that it's very hard to say, but it's interesting that they've come out with this new constitution because people have been asking that there be a return to a constitutional order, so this seems to have been something hastily arranged and trotted out.
What about the appointment of a transitional government to be swiftly followed by fresh elections? Is that the most likely way out of this crisis?
Well, it's really not quite clear, but according to some press reports, it seems that the coup leader has been summoning people to where he is outside of Bamako in this town, Kati, where there's this military base. And it seems that he's been trying to find a prime minister, but it's interesting that some of the leading presidential candidates for the elections that were scheduled next month have said categorically that they're not interested in serving as his prime minister. However, there's one opposition candidate who has said that he would be willing to serve as a prime minister, and he said this in an interview a few days ago. His name is Umar Mariko, and his party is called Sadi.
What else can you tell us about him?
I don't think that he's a very important political figure, and I don't think we should focus too much attention on that. I think that maybe it's more important to ask whether this coup is going to succeed, because, okay, yes, there have been supporters marching in the streets, and in recent media coverage from Malian state TV, you see many young people supporting this coup. But actually, the question is whether ordinary Malians are supporting this coup, and that doesn't seem very likely. You know, the coup that was led in 91, people went out in the streets to celebrate and to welcome the coup, and this is not happening this time. There seems to be quite a different mood, and in some ways this seems like it could be some sort of accidental coup, and that these young officers didn't really know what they were getting into, didn't seem to really have a plan, and then a week later they provide this new constitution. So far we've heard nothing from senior officers in the military, nothing from Mali's generals voicing support for this coup. Nearly all of the country's political parties have come out in opposition to this.
Mali's neighbors have threatened sanctions and the use of force if the junta fails to restore civilian rule. Yeah. From your knowledge of the region and the Malian military, what impact are such threats likely to have?
Well, I think that they are significant. Some Western donors have also cut off non-humanitarian aid, and Mali is a very poor landlocked country that had a very poor harvest this year, so it faces a potential humanitarian crisis, and the threat of aid being cut off by the Europeans, the North Americans, you know, this is very serious. How is this junta going to pay salaries? How is this junta going to interact with Mali's main interlocutors?
The junta say they staged the coup because they were dissatisfied with the government's handling of the Tuareg rebellion. Presumably any settlement will take that into account, or is that assuming too much at this stage?
I think, you know, as many commentators have been noting, one of the immediate outcomes of the coup is that this is to the advantage of the rebels. All of this disarray in the southern part of Mali only helps them to advance further.
Benjamin Suarez from the African Studies Centre in Leiden in the Netherlands.
Africa Link, because Africa is more than just a headline.
In a surprise move, top negotiators from Sudan and South Sudan are to meet on Thursday in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa in a bid to avert an all-out war between their two countries following days of airstrikes and border violence. This was announced by officials on both sides. I asked our correspondent James Shimanyula whether they were likely to agree on a ceasefire.
Well, Mark, chances are high, but given the volatile situation on the ground, there is a possibility of the ceasefire being violated by either side, taking us back to square one, if I may put it that way. That is, the state of hostilities may be witnessed once again.
A summit between Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir and his southern counterpart Salva Kiir was due to take place in Juba next week, but has been cancelled. Wouldn't that have been a better forum for talks on ending hostilities?
Absolutely, I agree with you. That forum would have been appropriate for talks that could have led to the end of hostilities, but given that it was cancelled and no side is willing to allow room for them to meet and discuss as neighbors, it looks like we have missed a very important forum for ending hostilities.
The two sides are at loggerheads over the positioning of their common border and over how much the South should pay the North for the transit of its oil to the coast. Is there any chance that these two issues will be resolved soon?
The sooner the better, but it is too soon to say that the issues are to be resolved once and for all, shortly, not by the two sides per se. We need an international push that will push the two sides to the negotiation table, and we may be forced to have the U.S. use its power of speaking to both sides, and then the European Union may come in. The U.N. has to come in also. With the three or the four powerful forces, I believe something good may be coming shortly.
The talks in Addis Ababa are being mediated by the African Union. How can it encourage the two sides to settle their differences?
The African Union has had problems over the past few months. It has hosted the two sides before. I think it has hosted South Sudan and North Sudan four times. And each time it looks like when the African Union is succeeding to encourage the two sides to stop fighting, it looks like one side, the North, is always two steps ahead of the African Union. So the African Union's efforts may translate into nothing but just back to where we were.
How tense is the situation on the ground in Sudan militarily?
Extremely tense, with each side beefing up its troops. And already as we speak, they are going for each other's jugular vein. And it's just worrying the neighbors, because with the neighbors watching events unfolding there, then security of the region is actually starting to be disturbed.
If a ceasefire is agreed, how difficult will it be to enforce?
It will be difficult indeed, because no side is capable of policing or guarding the porous border. We are talking of 1,800 kilometers separating the two countries, and that is actually what I can characterize as a meandering stretch of land, a mass land. And just to add to what you talked about, the two sides agreeing on probably one of the elements that has been making them fight, that is oil. The North has been demanding $36 for each barrel of oil exported through its pipeline. And that charge is disputed by the South, which goes with the world trade standards. And the South says that it wants to pay less than $1 per barrel. And you know, Mark, it's oil that is bringing all these problems, because the North is now feeling a pinch because they are losing a lot of money without getting oil from the South.
James Shimanyula.
Behind the headlines.
And this week's Behind the Headlines also takes us to Sudan. More than 100,000 refugees have already fled from the north to South Sudan. They were escaping the bombing and the hunger in southern Kordofan and Blue Nile states. The bombing has prevented people from farming and food is running out. Aid agencies are struggling to provide food and other supplies for the new arrivals, and it's a race against time before the onset of the rainy season. Then the roads become impassable and supplies have to be air freighted in, which is three times as expensive. Jared Ferry visited the Jaman refugee camp on the border in South Sudan's Upper Nile state.
In a dried-up watering hole, dozens of women and children are digging into the cracked earth to extract water. Standing waist-deep, they scoop it from pits and fill their containers, one cup at a time. There's a water shortage here in Jaman refugee camp, where people from Blue Nile State in Sudan have fled across the border into South Sudan to escape war and hunger. Magda Dokowaka says it takes 2 or 3 hours to fill a container, but that's better than waiting in line at a distribution point.
We used to make lines there and fetch water from the tap, but now, 2 days, we don't have water, and that's why all of us shifted here.
Because of a lot of people fighting at the water point, that's why we end up fetching here, because we don't want to fight.
The aid agency Oxfam is drilling boreholes here, but the drills often don't hit water. When they do, the boreholes often collapse because the earth is not the right consistency. Oxfam is bringing water in trucks to distribution points, where people queue for hours just to receive the bare minimum for survival. Dowdy Makamba is a public health engineer with Oxfam.
And how much water are they getting every day? What's the allotment?
For the moment, we have an average of 5 to 6 liters per person per day. For survival, it's from 3 liters up to 7 liters. But for basic water needs like drinking, bathing, and washing, we need at least to have from 7.5 up to 15 liters per person per day.
Water shortages are just one of the problems this camp is facing. Aid agencies are struggling to keep up with the rising tide of refugees. More than 30,000 have arrived in this camp over the past 3 months. Most of them have camped out on an area that will flood when the rains come. Aid officials say they will need to move these people to higher ground within the next 3 weeks.
These people, when they flew from the location, they came, they tried to find a better place to stay. So when they came here, they came straight up to this area, and we found some, most of them here, and now we're trying to move them to the safe area.
Anur Abudik Said is a paramount chief. He says the government of Omar al-Bashir favors Sudan's lighter-skinned population. He says Bashir is using aerial bombardment to drive the darker-skinned people like him out of the country.
Umar says he don't want black people in the Blue Nile, and he want to finish all of us the way he's bombing us now. He's almost killing us. So I don't think peace will come.
The refugees will keep arriving as long as the war continues, but agencies are already struggling to provide food, water, and medical care to more than 100,000 people who have fled from Sudan into South Sudan. When the rainy season starts here in the next few weeks, many of the roads will become flooded and impossible to drive. So aid workers need to make sure they have enough supplies in position to provide for those already here, plus tens of thousands, or perhaps even hundreds of thousands, who could arrive in the months to come.
Jared Ferry reporting from Jaman refugee camp in South Sudan's Upper Nile state.
Africa Link, bringing you the story behind the story.
Uganda's top opposition politician Kizza Besigye pleaded not guilty on Wednesday to charges of unlawful assembly. The case arose from the death of a policeman in violent street clashes last week, which the authorities say was caused by a rock thrown by one of Besigye's supporters. Lila Ndinda was in court in Kampala, and I asked her to tell us what had happened.
The court was full from as early as 9 a.m. Besigye had said he was going to walk from home to court. So his supporters were ready to accompany him. But in the morning, when he was leaving home, police stopped him and told him, you cannot walk, you're going to use your car. And by the time he arrived at court, his supporters already camped outside chanting, singing slogans. They had this popular song where they were saying, Museveni and Inspector General of Police will one day go and the fight should go on. So they sat quietly through the morning session for almost 45 minutes. Then the court was adjourned for 15 minutes, and then it resumed again because, first of all, Besigye and four co-accused pleaded not guilty. And then the defense team asked the court to grant bail to Besigye and his co-accused. So he was given bail, And even after the proceedings, his supporters were there. They sang and encouraged him and told him he's not in the fight all by himself. They're supporting him all through.
What happens next?
Well, what happened next is Besigye said he wanted to walk to town to have lunch, but there were policemen deployed around the court, all very armed. And one policeman who was in command came and told Besigye was not supposed to hold a procession. And Besigye tells him, well, I'm not holding a procession because I'm from court and I'm walking to eat. The police commander told him, no, you're not going to walk. So they forced him to use his car and drive off. Besigye wanted to use particular routes that the police was not comfortable with. So they literally led him through Kampala City, and his followers were also there chanting and singing. But at some point, police realized the crowds were gathering, so they started shooting in the air. After almost 30 minutes, Besigye was escorted to his office.
Presumably, the police were so keen on him taking his car because he's been leading these walk-to-work rallies. Is that correct?
Yes, it is very correct, because they are scared that every time Besigye walks, he's followed by multitudes of people. And when these multitudes of people follow him, in most cases, we always see people being injured because police says these people working with Besigye are hooligans and they intend to loot property and harm people. But Besigye says, no, look here, these people are just walking peacefully. Chaos only erupts when police tries to tear gas the crowds to disperse them. But then Besigye also says some of the people who follow him, they're actually not his supporters. They are people planted in the crowds by the police so that they can cause chaos and then pass the blame to the opposition. So it becomes a little bit tricky because we do not know who to believe, whether to believe the police or to believe Besigye. All we know is when Besigye has a confrontation with police, somehow, somewhere, tear gas is fired and people get injured.
What is the next step in the court proceedings?
Well, Besigye was granted bail and is supposed to appear in court on the 17th of next month.
What is he charged with?
Police say that he's charged with managing an unlawful society. What they didn't define is what an unlawful society is, because according to the law, these laws were written during the colonial era of this country, that is in the 50s. And according to the law, an unlawful society is supposed to be defined by the governor of Britain. So we do not know whether we are supposed to wait for the governor of Britain to come to Uganda and explain what this unlawful society means. Because as it stands, nobody understands what this unlawful society is.
Is there any indication that Besigye was targeted, that his arrest could have been politically motivated?
We get different opinions from different people. The police saying, hey, look here, we know you're organizing a revolution and we're not going to allow you to do that. And Besigye says, no, I'm not organizing a revolution. What I'm doing here is sensitizing the public and telling them, you know what, the inflation rate is high, the cost of living has gone high, most of you cannot afford a decent livelihood, so it's time to wake up and fight for your rights.
Leila Ndinda in Kampala.
Opinion.
And in this week's opinion, we'd like to hear what you think of recent events in Mali.
Nous demandons à la population malienne de rester sereine et de garder son calme.
That was coup leader Captain Amadou Sanogo appealing for calm on Malian television shortly after the putsch in Bamako last week. Those mounting the coup accused the government of incompetence in fighting the Tuareg rebellion. They say that's why they decided to take control of the country into their own hands. An international outcry followed, urging Mali to return to civilian rule. So how much damage do you think the coup has done to the country? Will it quickly find its way back to democracy, or should Malians be bracing themselves for a period of extended authoritarian rule? Let us know what you think. Our email address is feedback.africa@dw.de. Our postal address, Africa Link, DW 53110, Bonn, Germany. And before we leave you, a brief reminder of the stories we've been covering in this edition of Africa Link. Several thousand people have taken to the streets of Mali's capital Bamako in support of last week's military takeover. ECOWAS is sending a group of presidents to the country to try and restore constitutional order. Top negotiators from Sudan and South Sudan are expected to meet in Addis Ababa on Thursday in a bid to avoid further violence after 3 days of border clashes and airstrikes. And in a court in Kampala, Uganda's top opposition politician Kizza Besigye has pleaded not guilty to charges of unlawful assembly. And there we come to the end of this edition of Africa Link. Please remember, we always welcome your comments on this programme. That email address for you once again, feedback.africa@dw.de. Until the next time, thank you for listening. This is Mark Caldwell in Bonn.